Costs to originate keep rising, even with more technology in the industry. The problem is the core platform. A new LOS can re-architect the process around data, not humans moving paper files. Vesta has built this LOS, and you can learn more at vesta.com.
Pulled from the hottest topics coming across our news desk. I'm Victoria Jones, and this is Housing Wire Daily. Today's Housing Wire Daily interview features a crossover episode of Housing Wire's Housing News podcast. In this episode, Housing Wire Editor-in-Chief Sarah Wheeler interviews Ryan Lundquist, market analyst and owner of Lundquist Appraisal Company and author of the Sacramento Appraisal Blog. During the episode, Lundquist discusses how the appraisal sector fared during the initial onset of the COVID-19 pandemic and how appraisers are navigating this year's hot housing market. But before we listen, here's a brief word from our sponsor.
As a top 10 subservicer with a 98% customer satisfaction rate, TMS does business a different way, and it does it well. They deliver next-level service with next-level technology innovations. Like Simi, their servicing portal that can help make a lender's job a breeze. So when you're ready to have the service put back into your subservicing, go to subservicing.themoneysource.com.
Welcome, everyone. This is Sarah Wheeler, Editor-in-Chief at HousingWire, with the latest episode of our Housing News podcast. I'm excited to introduce our guest today, Ryan Lundquist. Ryan Lundquist is a certified residential appraiser in the Sacramento area, and he also writes the very popular Sacramento Appraisal Blog, where he talks about trends he's seeing there and really serves as a source of information for other appraisers. Ryan has been an affiliate member of the Sacramento Association of Realtors for more than a decade, and he was awarded the Affiliate of the Year in 2014. He's also a board member of the Real Estate Appraisers Association of Sacramento. Ryan, welcome.
Hey, thank you so much, Sarah. Really appreciate getting to be here. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. We're so excited to have you. So I'd love to start out on housing news. We really want to know, how did people get where they are? Were you 8 years old and were like, I definitely want to be an appraiser? Is that how that worked?
You know, there's probably not too many eight-year-olds out there who are dreaming of being appraisers. I think, frankly, mostly everyone who ends up working in real estate gets there by accident. And for me, I was a teacher in a previous life, and my wife got pregnant by me. And we ended up, I needed a career change. I needed to make more money. And that's what it came down to. I knew some appraisers. I asked them to train me, and they did. And so it was as simple as that. There were no aspirations. I honestly wake up sometimes going, who am I? What in the world? Why am I excited about Excel and numbers and telling the story of the market? And I never anticipated that. And so I'm having a good time.
You are, and you know, you're really known nationally because of your appraisal blog. So tell me how you decided to start writing that and what you get out of it. You know, what does that look like on a weekly basis, and why do you keep doing it?
Yeah, so for the past 12 years, I've written a blog, and I put out one post per week. At first, of course, I was doing four or five because that's just way too much. You can't keep a subscriber list if you're putting out too much content. But one a week, and it's just really to, you know, to put myself out there, to touch base with people. It really began as a way to, I wanted to attract the type of clients that I wanted. You know, I saw sort of the writing on the wall in the profession, at least, and thinking that, you know, I don't want to be a part or a victim to the AMC model as much as possible. And so I want to try to do more private work. And it's really helped me diversify, but it's really morphed into this thing. I love it. It's this conversation piece. It's a tool just to connect with people and to be a resource. And so it's sort of all of the above. It sort of checks a lot of boxes, I think, in my life. A lot of passions, really. I know that sounds maybe nerdy, but it's really true.
We love nerdy. And I can say, because I'm a frequent reader of it, you engage. It's really a community of people that you're engaging with. So people send you questions. They might be new to the area or new to the profession. And you always take your time to really walk through your methods with them and kind of try to answer their questions. So I think it's much more than just like you putting something out. It's definitely seems like a conversation you're having with people in the space.
Absolutely. You know, it's a relationship. And I think sometimes like the way we view social media is so backwards, or blogging, it's sort of like this, I'm going to blast out this thing and, you know, everyone's just going to listen or whatever. That's just so backwards. And so it's more like, I want to share this content that becomes something else where, you know, the post is one thing, but then it's all about the comments. What are people saying? What are we learning down there? You know, just like we read any article today, this is a nice article, but let me go straight to the comments. I want to see how people are engaging. And that's where it's at for me, not only on the blog, but taking the content on Facebook and Instagram and wherever, and just being able to dialogue and have conversation. I learn a lot from other people myself just through these conversations. So it's fun.
That's great to hear. Well, bring us up to speed. You know, appraisals have been in the news as long as I've been at HousingWire 7 years, and they're a continual source of, you know, things that are going great in the industry and different ways. And then they can be the pain point in the lending process. People can, right now they seem to, you know, most of the noise around them is around the appraisal gap that we're seeing in different parts. But I would love to have you recap what you've seen over the last year, you know, during COVID and then now into this year. What does business look like? What did it look like in those early months? And then what happened, you know, starting last May or so?
Absolutely. So when COVID first began, I think, you know, the market stalled, you know, prices sort of sloughed for a couple of weeks. You know, pendings were sloughing for about 4 to 6 weeks. And, you know, it's sort of, I think a lot of people were watching going, is this it? You know, is the market going to start doing something else? But then there was this dramatic rebound. No mistaking, coincidentally, or no coincidence, I should say, when mortgage rates went below 3%, and people are motivated by the pandemic, it just brought everyone and their mom out to the housing market. And so it's been a bloodbath since then. I think that this is the most aggressive market we've had. It feels like there's about twice as many buyers compared to the number of listings, even on a national scale. And so I would say that the market is wildly imbalanced. I would say words like chaos describe it very well. It shouldn't be this difficult to obtain housing and to find shelter, but it is. That's what we have right now. And in terms of appraisals, I think the difficulty is that we have this auction environment where, you know, buyers are bidding way beyond anything that's reasonable. And so an appraiser goes in there and is answering the question, what's not the highest auction price possible, but what is a reasonable value that the lender should lend on this property that represents what the lender should lend? And so I think market value and auction value are two different things. And so there's been a lot of hostility toward appraisers for a lot of reasons. And of course, when an appraisal comes in lower than it should, I mean, obviously, people should be upset. If there's a quality problem in the profession, people ought to be upset. But I think a lot of people know at times, though, too, that, you know, there's no way this thing should appraise at the contract price. And so I have a client who bought in October. I re-inspected his property the other day. I'm doing a private appraisal for him. And he told me, he said, I paid cash for this property. I paid about 15% above the list price, and now today I think it's worth probably what I paid for then. And so he was fully aware in October that he was overpaying, right? Now we can scrutinize that from the outside and say, oh, you know, the appraisal came in low, but you know, it should have. Or I was pulling comps the other day and I thought, why is this one so much higher? And so I emailed the agent. The agent was very communicative. I really appreciate it. And I said, hey, did any chance that the buyer paid above the appraised value? Yes, the buyer did, $50,000 above. And sure enough, this one was about 50 grand higher than the other ones. And so I think we're in an interesting market like that. And where I think the easy target is the appraisers, of course. I mean, for so many reasons that is. But I think we have to back up and go, you know, appraisers aren't responsible for these lopsided conditions. You know, having over a decade of not enough new construction, going through a global pandemic, and having a shift in demographics, people staying in their homes longer, less listings coming to market. We have the largest generation millennials who are now, you know, in the market buying homes. There's so many reasons why the market is the way it is right now. And I think that we have to, in some senses, concede that, you know, yeah, there's some problems with appraisals, but appraisers haven't caused this market. And, you know, I feel for buyers. I really, really do. But, you know, the appraiser's role isn't to sort of match that auction price and get the deal done. That's just not the fundamental role.
Well, and it never was, but especially, you know, in light of the things that were put in after the last financial crisis, you know, this, you guys are now one of the safeguards, right? So that, you know, that arm's length relationship, so that that doesn't happen the way that it did then. So it is an interesting turn, but tell me a little bit. So, you know, I bought a house during the pandemic. I obviously, as editor in chief of HousingWire, I'm constantly reading about real estate and the market and things like that. So it's hard for me as just a layperson to go, how do you come up with, like, when you say market value is not the same as auction value, how do you distinguish between those two? How would you define those two?
So I don't know if there's a definition for auction value, a formal one, but I would say that that's, you know, some person's version of, here's what it's going to take to get this accepted. And I'm just offering this amount arbitrarily, probably, or here's what I think it will take to get into contract, right? Market value would be the most probable price this property should bring in an open market. And, you know, basically, if you lined up 100 buyers, what's the most reasonable, realistic price that this property should bring? And so, you know, I'm just saying that there can be a vast difference at times. With that said, though, the market has been moving very, very quickly. In Sacramento, the past 90 days, our median price has increased by 11.3% in 90 days, right? Our prices are all metrics are up about 20% from last year at the same time. And here we are in our 10th year of price growth. And we had this dramatic turn where the market was slowing down, and then all of a sudden it's driving 120 miles per hour. And so somehow in the midst of this, the appraiser answers the question, you know, what's the most reasonable value here? And I'll say, I mean, it's not easy to decipher that. You know, like I said, you know, this feels very chaotic. But in the midst of that, you know, the appraiser's role isn't just to say that, yeah, to sort of ratify, you know, the highest offer ever, which probably, you know, might not reflect the value. So, you know, let's put it this way. I mean, what if a lender did a loan on that property back in October for the full amount? And it really was in contract 15% too high. Like right now in May 2021, it's probably worth what that guy paid. Okay, but we have this dynamic where I think a lot of buyers are going, you know, I'm going to overpay, and then maybe hopefully the market will increase, and then I won't be, you know, sort of underwater. But, you know, we have this dynamic where I think a lot of people are getting into contract too high. They're paying cash above the appraised value. And it's the nature of the beast. I mean, of course, to be fair, at some point we have to ask, well, does that represent the market? Right. And so I think that that's a fair question that every appraiser and market professional has to ask. But we have to be aware, though, that fundamentally that, you know, what is the appraiser's role here? And, you know, and what is the market's role? And just conceding that, gosh, I mean, I think everyone knows that it's not always there. You know, even agents I talk to behind the scenes, they're like, yeah, there's no way this one is going to appraise. Or sometimes it does appraise that high. Then they thought, I don't know how that happened. It was magic.
So interesting. You know, you're talking about Sacramento, and we know that Sacramento has been one of the hottest markets. So tell us a little bit about your market. You're in California, so it's not like it's been a backwater at any point, but tell us about what has happened over the last year. Where are you seeing all those buyers come from, and what do you attribute that to?
Yeah. So what's interesting to me is that as I talk with colleagues and other real estate professionals across the country, this chaotic dynamic, it's really happening just about everywhere. And so even though there's no such thing as a national market, all we have thousands of submarkets that make up the United States, but really we're kind of going in that same direction. And so it's interesting to compare notes. So I'll say what we're experiencing here isn't foreign to probably where you are. But One dynamic that we have that other people might not have as much, though, we do have increased Bay Area migration. And so when you look at like migration data in both out of New York and San Francisco, you know, Manhattan and San Francisco, there was a greater exodus from those cities. Now, some of the migration stats, it's actually overblown. I mean, everyone thinks, you know, everyone's leaving everywhere. But, you know, but really there was something legitimate that happened in San Francisco and Manhattan. And so we have been the recipient of more Bay Area migration. Now, in my market, it's easy to sort of blame everything on the Bay, right? I imagine like in Austin, it's all about like, it's everyone from California that's making our market move. Or in Florida, everyone says, it's everyone coming from New York. And it's like almost, my observation is that every single market blames someone else, right? But the reality is that even though there's increased Bay Area migration, we have a really chaotic environment because buyers are hungry. Local buyers are pulling the trigger. And sometimes I feel like the narrative is maybe understating that or not recognizing that this dynamic of aggressive real estate is actually happening everywhere. And so sometimes when people say, it's just the Bay Area, I say, well, but the market feels like this all across the country, right? And one dynamic we've seen in Sacramento and even across the United States is a focus on the high end. And so luxury sales have really come alive. Again, part of that's Bay Area. Part of it is people moving up and being, I think, propelled by COVID. I think the pandemic was a catalyst to help people sort of get off the benches and say, you know, I want to get into the game and I'm going to make real estate decisions. I'm going to buy that house. I want more space in an outlying county. I want more land. I want that house with a pool. And, you know, and so I feel like COVID has really, you know, made that happen. And really in my market, I wouldn't be surprised if this was true across the country, but for the past 11 months, we've actually seen more sales compared to the previous year. And so the narrative in real estate is that we don't have enough listings. And it's actually, that's true. But the reality is we are seeing more sales happen. And so buyers are basically buying everything that's on the market. It feels really tight out there, but we've actually seen higher volume. Frankly, if we had more listings, we would see even higher volume than what we have seen. But that's kind of, I think, my market in a nutshell. I mean, we can geek out on a bunch of stats if you want. I think we'll lose anyone listening, though. But that's kind of how I describe it.
No, I appreciate those insights. And you know, we saw early on, I feel like you were one of the earliest markets to get that coming in from the Bay Area, or that we saw a pop. Was, and probably because you're, you know, closer than some other markets, but we were like, Sacramento, why is Sacramento on the top of this list? Wait, let's look. And you guys have stayed, you know, in the top metro for movers. So it is interesting to hear you, you know, say, yes, that's part of it, but also just people, you know, the low rates and the demographics, you know, also there's some part of that that was just going to happen. So I think that's it's an interesting confluence of things. I will say that it seems like people in other parts of the country, you know, you being in California, I feel like you probably have more experience just over the years that you've been an appraiser of, yes, this is a very chaotic market, but you're used to rising home prices in a way that, say, someone from my market in Dallas, we're just really not. I mean, you know, the amount of what I paid for my houses versus anything in your area would just be, you know, ridiculous. And there wasn't just that huge appreciation right before the crash. You know, we didn't have any of that. So this is really, for me anyway, this has been one of the first sort of run-ups that I've seen or quick home price appreciation, not just here, but in Texas. I have a son in Austin, which obviously has been one of the hottest markets. And so, you know, what are some of the things that, you know, you could take from your experience and share to people who are like, you know, I'm in Pueblo, Colorado. I haven't had to, you know, appraise a house in this sort of rising rate environment before. You know, what are some of the things you would say to them?
Well, first off, I guess I'll just say welcome to California. Everyone bashes California, but at least I could say now that, hey, welcome to what trends are normally like here. We are a market of extremes. I think sometimes appraiser colleagues look on some of my graphs and go, I just can't believe this. Like, maybe they've had more appreciation lately, but they see our last few real estate cycles and the wild up and down swings, and you know, and so they're really blown away. But I'd say in some senses, I think the whole country has actually experienced what the Bay Area is normally like. Okay, the Bay Area is about within 2 hours of Sacramento, and their market is honestly normally like this, okay? And Sacramento is not normally so chaotic, but it's sort of morphed into, I think, what the Bay Area feels like, and everyone's getting a taste. And so I just say to everyone that just be aware that markets don't last, okay? Markets are constantly changing. In my office, I have something hanging on the wall that says the market is always moving, and it's just true. And this market won't last forever. I know it feels like it will last forever, but you know, you have to just ride the wave that is here. And it's hard to give specific advice for that other than just to say, interpret the market as it comes. And a market like this will keep you on your toes. I think for real estate professionals anyway, what a market like this forces people to do, theoretically, what it should do is it forces us to change our narrative and to let the stats actually form what we say about the market, right? The temptation in real estate is to be like, hey, it's a good time to buy. It's a good time to sell. Those cliches don't work, okay? What does it mean to be a market expert? We have to get down and dirty in the numbers and to really know how are they moving? How are things changing within the market? And so if we have wild swings, what that does is it forces people to have to be that expert, okay? If everything is always the same, we could be like, yep, the market's stable. You know, this is good. This is how it is. And in Fort Worth and Dallas, no problem. But when things start to be chaotic, it forces people to have to look and go, okay, let me try to understand what's going on here and find language to explain this. Okay. Because, you know, we talk a lot about in real estate about tech companies and, you know, taking over, you know, humans. And I you know, that's a whole nother podcast probably. But I think that one of the things that the humans need to do is to watch the market and to, I think, hone the numbers and to lasso them in and to tame them and to find language to describe this market. So that would be, I think, my biggest takeaway or biggest bit of advice for anyone.
That's great advice. I know that we've talked before, and I quoted you last week about how you're really looking at how you as an appraiser make sense of that as things are rising so hard. How do you find that? How do you find that true value? And so I would love for you to talk a little bit about how you track that trend, like your scatter graphs and, you know, kind of what your process looks like.
Yeah. So I think that to use cat lovers will hate me, but I'll say there's different ways to skin a cat, right? A horrible metaphor, but there, I just said it. But it's probably true. So I don't think that there's one way to look at a market, but I'll say for me, philosophically first, we have to realize that sales represent the past, okay? Sales are historical artifacts that tell us what the market used to be like. And so if something closed in early May 2021, but it got in a contract in April, well, that tells me more about the market in April when it got into contract. How has the market changed since that property sold or got into contract? Well, let me look to the pendings today. Let me look and try to gauge demand and, you know, what's going on, you know, with days on market, how much more are properties getting bid up? You know, these are sort of clues into the market. And so if I have, for instance, you know, sales that closed in May, but they got into contract in February or March, and say they're at $500,000, but then all my pendings, as if it ever works this way, it's all neat on paper. It hardly ever works this way, but say all my pendings are at $525,000. Okay. There's no rule that says how much a market can increase over time. I think sometimes people in the real estate space say 1% per month, you know, I'd say no, there's no rule. It can be less than that. It can decline. It can go up way more. And so if all my pendings are say at 525, that's a clue that maybe the market is going up quite rapidly. And what helps me sort of supplement what I'm seeing in the pendings, and I'm calling the agent saying, what are you in contract for? Right? Those properties start closing and, well, those are indicators of value as long as they're legit. If everyone's overpaying for something, I got to kind of weigh the pending and go, hey, is that really real, or is this just an example of a buyer overpaying some pendings I'm going to throw out, just like I am for some sales, because, hey, that person paid $50,000 above the appraisal. That's just not a legit situation. But I'm pairing this with my scatter graphs also. Right. I even have tutorials online. If anyone wants to know how to make a graph, I mean, that stuff is there. It's so easy to do. I don't have a background as a nerd. I didn't get a degree in nerddom. I used to be a teacher, but, you know, here I am messing with Excel and, you know, looking at trend lines and going, yeah, this is really steep. And lately on my graphs, the trend line has been unreal. I can't believe how steep it is. And so like I said, for a while, the market was kind of flattening out. So this trend line is flattening, but right now it's just going to the moon, so to speak, to steal from Dogecoin.
I got to steal from Dogecoin. Come on, those cryptocurrencies. That's a whole other podcast that we need to do, but definitely appreciate that. You know, one of the things that I think that we think about when we think about a person doing an appraisal versus a machine learning, you know, algorithm, whatever, is that there are these intangibles. And one of the intangibles that you talked about, I think yesterday or this week on your blog, was some really interesting houses that had that sort of mid-century vibe, or they had a something that really appealed to home buyers right now. And I guess that's my question, is how do you factor something in like that? Because it's like, you know, you can look at two houses and okay, they're, you know, they're generally the same, whatever. But then you have that intangible thing that's kind of hard to see if you were just looking at stats, that when you go in or when someone else goes in and goes, this is going to be more valuable to people because it speaks to whatever zeitgeist is at the time. I would say mid-century because I remember my parents had mid-century furniture. I wasn't a huge fan, right? Because that's what I grew up. My kids love mid-century. That's what they want, which just cracks me up. I'm like, I'll take that orange Naga hide couch that I had growing up. I'll give that to you. If only I still had it. But how do you factor that in when in this market, when you know there's so few of these kind of things, or this is what everyone's looking for? Like, how does that factor in?
Yeah, no, it gets really tricky. So you just guess. No, I'm just kidding. So you really have to look to the market for the answers. And that's always the deal in the valuation space, where we have to let the market tell the story. And so if a property really is special in the eyes of the market, like not in my eyes, I need to, you know, look at every house the same, all that stuff. But if a house is special, like this mid-century home I wrote about that sold, I mean, way above what it looked like it should have. Okay. And maybe it did close too high also. I mean, I'll let people be the judge of that. But I have to look to other mid-century comps. You know, what are buyers paying for? Because if something is commanding a premium, I should be able to see that premium in other sales, in other pending data, and in talking to agents also, and relying on them saying, what are buyers asking for? What are they looking for? Or like in my market, in 2020, we saw an 8.4% increase in the number of homes with pools sold. And so it was a big deal during the pandemic to quarantine in style in the backyard. And so all of a sudden, the backyard pandemic paradise has become a huge deal. And so on paper, you might have, you know, Zestimates or, you know, Redfin or, you know, whatever algorithm we would look at that says, okay, this lot is 0.15 acres. It's a very standard, you know, postage stamp lot. But what is on there can make a huge difference, whether a pool or the covered patio or the built-in barbecue and the bocce ball and the panoramic view. And so there's things that do feel more intangible or ethereal, and where we have to sort of be in tune with what are buyers really looking for right now. And as from an appraisal perspective, that comes from crunching the numbers. It comes from, I think, relationships in the real estate community. It comes from listening to the numbers. It comes from just all these conversations. And so I just think that's really critical. But yeah, it's fascinating because I think tastes are always changing, you know, like the saying, I mean, like cottage cheese texture used to be really popular, not so much anymore, right? I hope it never comes back, but it just shows that things are like the home office is a really big deal right now. Or in my area, there's two counties that have experienced really steep growth. And so there's a lot of migration into both those counties. It's not only Bay Area, but a lot of locals are going, you know, I want to be on the outskirts of town, not quite rural area, but I want to have more space. I want to feel like I'm less confined. And so this idea of, you know, needing that space as a result of the quarantine, it's been very, very real. But here's the thing, will that last or will that eventually contract when people are working not from home anymore? I mean, we don't know the answers to those questions, but right now, those things have become more valuable. And there's certain locations that are more valuable, you know, whether it's the pool and whatnot, or the county or the city, you know, simply because buyers' tastes have changed.
Well, and to that point, I mean, you don't know how long. It also depends on like what the impact of COVID had on individual people. So there are some people who are probably like just the impact of this is like, I'm never living in a crowded, you know, apartment building, or I'm never living in a condo, or that sounds terrible. There are other people who, you know, a couple of years from now, or even now, are like, no, I can't wait to get back to that. So it's also, especially after this year, very hard to determine how long those things are going to be important to people. And just the importance of it wasn't just like, oh, here's a fad, here's a taste, but like something that was so traumatic for people. That's gonna live with them for a while. And how does that, you know, have the memory going forward 10 years from now? Are people still, you know, the people who maybe were affected at this time be like, yeah, no, I still want space? Or are people going to be going back to that? You know, what we heard 2 years ago was like, millennials want, you know, stacked living and walkable neighborhoods and everything right there and very, very dense, you know, communities. It'll be interesting to see. And I just don't know how you see that, as opposed to like what you said, just watching the stats and seeing as things change, you're going to be able to see it in the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, trends are constantly changing. Like, you know, here we are, I see kids wearing fanny packs. And I'm like, I would feel like a major dork. I would be a dork. I would be mocked by my teenagers if I wore that, right? But, you know, here we are, and there's some pop punk rock starting to come out again. And I'm, you know, thanking God, like going grunge 2.0, let's repeat the 90s. I'm there for it. I'm ready, okay? But things are constantly changing. And ironically, there was so much attention on tiny homes, you know, but it's like, I don't hear very much right now. That's not to say that tiny home builders aren't going crazy, but just this idea of having less space, that's not so keen on people's lists right now. Okay. And so I would just say that things are constantly changing. Even condo sales in my market, and I would suspect in many markets, have sloughed. Okay, they haven't grown as much as those single-family detached homes with the backyard, because that's what, you know, people tend to want. And so, you know, things are constantly changing. Styles and music and real estate and people's tastes. You know, what they want in life. And I mean, that's to me the whole fascinating part about real estate. And we never know what would want. And even from a COVID standpoint, you'd think that, yeah, I don't want to live in a hippie commune. You know, but here's the irony: is that you know, those hippie commune developments probably didn't do too well at the beginning, but at the same time, people crave community. And I think this is not really a real estate note, but just I think coming out of the pandemic, we can recognize that we can't do life alone. We need other people in our lives. And it's not working to be isolated. You have to have relationships intact. And so I think that, you know, a community like that, would it thrive right now? It would freak some people out, right? But other people would go, I have tasted what isolation is like, and I can't do this. And so, like you said, I mean, COVID, I think, hit everyone differently. And I think we're all coming out of this in different ways. You know, we'll have different effects. And some people are angry and, you know, really upset about politics. And I'm like, hey, you know, go over there, okay? If that's what you want to do in your life, too much negativity, don't live there, people. There's more to life than, you know, political talking points. And oh my gosh, you know. So anyway, I'm going off on a tangent, but I can't believe what I read, though, when I log on to Facebook and I think, are you still complaining about that? Or like, are we going to live there in perpetual negativity, whether you wear a mask or not? And it's just like, you know, there is more to life. We've got to tap into what really matters, which is relationship. Well, so that was my sermon.
I appreciate that, Summer. We are in interesting times, as I say. I did an interview with Sean Telford, who's the chief appraiser at CoreLogic, and kind of asked him about some stats, because one thing that we hear is just, you know, the appraisal gap is constant. You know, it's being talked about on different forums. We're on calls with people. It's just out there, right? That's what people are talking about, because that's what's going on. But when I asked him about the stats on that, which they're a stat company, they're a numbers company. I love getting data from them. They showed that, you know, before the pandemic, about 8% of appraisals came in below the contract price on a national basis. So these are national numbers. So again, you're going everywhere from San Francisco to, you know, the middle of nowhere. So, but 8%. And then if you look at since just October 2020 till now, if you look at that whole thing, that's risen to about 14% of properties. The appraisal is coming in below the contract price. And then if you narrow that window to just the last 3 months, it shoots up to 17%. So there is definitely, it's not just anecdotal, right? We can see that appraisals and contract prices there's a gap there. But whether that gap is, you know, good or bad is the question. And I think I'd want to go back to what you said about how people are kind of using appraisers as a scapegoat or you know, really being upset at the appraiser when it's not, the anger is not placed correctly in that thing. Are you surprised by those numbers, or does that seem about right to you? Because I thought it was going to come out much higher. For the noise that appraisal gap is, I thought it was going to be like 60% of, you know, because we see that how many homes are having bidding wars. So I expected that number to be higher. But from your perspective, is that still pretty high?
You know, I don't have much context to say whether that's high or not, because I never have access to that stat. But I'm frankly not surprised, because it's a reflection of the market. You know, especially since January, we've had this market that's been moving, I think, more quickly than probably any market we've ever had. And like in my market, on average last month, buyers paid $24,000 above the original list price, right? And so, and we don't have an overpriced market. We have this market, when you line up 2,500 sales, to get to that number at 24,000 is just massive, okay? And so in my market, 104% or 4% above the original list price is what buyers basically paid. And so, you know, it makes sense when appraisers are going out there and appraising deals. It's like, well, we have this chaotic environment. On one hand, appraisers absolutely need to recognize that prices are increasing. They need to do a good job. We need to do a good job measuring the market. Okay. If we say we're really reflecting the market, but not giving adjustments up to the sales when the market's gone up, then, you know, shame on us. We're not doing a good job. But I think also what we have to recognize too is that you would think that 80% of appraisals are coming in lower, but you know, I think the noise from that 17% is sort of the vocal minority, and so we have, I think, you know, a lot of complaining. I think appraisers are just getting, you know, kicked to the curb on all the major forums online, you know, but I can't remember any post this year that came back and said, hey, I'm really grateful that this appraiser did a wonderful job. Not that I'm fishing for that. That would be kind of weird, to be honest, but I'm just saying is that people go to these forums to complain. All right. And that's human nature. And so I think that forms our perception where we think that everything is coming in lower or there's no appraiser doing a good job out there, when I would say, well, you know, what about the 83% of the deals that did go through? And, you know, that's not to justify or to explain away any issues that we're having where if something legitimately came in lower. But, you know, I think sometimes our perception is maybe skewed from, you know, from that 17%, though, so to speak.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. And I think that, you know, even on your blog this week, you talked about, you know, that only 2.8% of all sales last month had 20 offers or more. Well, you would think if you're a seller right now, you're like, I'm going to get 20 offers and I can put this outrageous price on there. And it's just, again, that's the one you hear. That's what you're going to hear your neighbors talking about. And that's what, you know, comes through. But that 2.8%, that's obviously higher than normal, but that's not, 2.8% is pretty small.
Well, yeah, and I think the danger in a market like today is that we sometimes let the sensational numbers form our perception of reality. And so, you know, the reality, you know, the narrative becomes everything is getting bid up over $100,000. But then I crunch actual stats and say that that's not true. And, you know, everything is getting 20 offers. No, 97% of properties are getting way less than that. The average amount of offers is 5. Now, that's like twice as much as it should be. Okay. And I think sometimes I share that number and then local agents say, there's no way, you're off your rocker. What sort of pricing crack are you smoking? Like, you are so wrong. I'm like, no. That's what the numbers say. It's just what is normal. That's what we need to ask. And we should have about 2.5 offers in a normal or even competitive market, but having 5 on average is just crazy. But so I think that, like I said, this market is or should force every real estate professional to really know the numbers and to look at the numbers in a different way. Because otherwise, we're going to look at that example in the Bay Area where a property sold literally $1 million above its original list price. And we go, everything's getting up, bid up by $1 million. Or this viral example in my market, a property got 122 offers. And, you know, as soon as that happened, this story was going nuts. And people say, how am I ever going to get into a home? And then as the numbers guy, I step in there and go, you know, there have literally been, there's literally 4 sales or 4 pendings right now with 40 or more offers. We need to keep this in context. Like, let's look at that and go, this would never have this wouldn't happen in a market that's not so aggressive. Like, this is a symptom of a market that is very lopsided, but at the same time, it doesn't indicate, doesn't speak for everything out there right now in the marketplace. So that's kind of, I think, maybe my pedestal. And I don't know if that sounds arrogant, but I think it sounds very reasonable. And I think if real estate professionals want to continue to be relevant, they simply have to be more informed about the numbers and become incredible storytellers, conveying expertise in the local market. And that's constantly what I share in anything I'm sharing in my daily stats. I'm like, let's, you know, grasp this and hold on to it and really know that here's how the numbers work, here's why things are moving, et cetera, et cetera. So I don't want to keep beating the dead horse, to use another bad, metaphor for animals. So I'm cruel, I guess.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much. Really appreciate you sharing your insights today. It is a crazy market, as you said. We'll probably have you back on as we go through this year to see what it looks like and what some of these things have changed. 6 months from now will be really interesting. And in the meantime, really appreciate you and your insights.
Thank you, Sarah. This is a joy, and keep up the great work. Love what you guys are doing.
Now more than ever, the housing industry is looking to its leaders for answers. That's why each week, the Housing News Podcast invites a new mortgage, fintech, or real estate executive to the show to provide its listeners with more perspective on the announcements and news stories crossing HousingWire's news desk. Hosted by Sarah Wheeler and produced by Alcina Lloyd, the Housing News Podcast is now available on iTunes, Spotify, Apple, Google Podcasts, and more.
Thanks for listening to Housing Wire Daily as we wrap up this week's news coverage. As always, we like to remind you to hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode. Have a great weekend and catch everyone back here again on Monday.